Accession number 29238, reel 12.
Mr. Wigham, reel 12. We were just talking about the soya bean
milk. Well, I had this milk for just a day or two, and the effect was amazing. I used to be out of the latrines 14 and 15 times a night with the fluid just pouring away from me until I was way down below normal size, like in the end, you know. And then he put me onto a slightly improved diet, a solid diet, you know. But it was Henry and his soya beans that saved me. There were no two ways about it. And I was in that ward when I got word that my father had died 18 months late. He'd been dead for 18 months. I'd had a previous letter telling me he wasn't well. But I got two letters in the day. There were two deliveries, or dish outs anyway, shall we say, from the chaps who were sorted through them. I got one in the morning. A good thing the way they came round. One in the morning from my brother telling me he was sorry but father was very, very ill, and keep your fingers crossed but expect anything. And in the afternoon I got a letter from him telling me father was dead. Now Colonel Dean, who was down there then, of course, I believe I mentioned before on this, that he spent these days around the hospital talking to everybody, not just the lads in his regiment, anybody in hospital. Colonel Dean was around, so much so that the Aussies, who were pretty hard nuts, used to call him Daddy Dean, you know. And he stopped us always to see how I was, and pleased to see that I was looking a bit better. Did you get any post, Wigham? I said, yes, sir. We got a letter from my brother. How are things? I said, not too good, I'm afraid, not at all. And my father's very ill, I've been told, to expect anything. And, oh, keep your chin up, son. He says, things will turn out all right, don't you worry, lad. You know, just keep hoping. And off he went. And of course, I say, the afternoon I got the letter to say he was dead. Now, Tommy Denton came round to see me in the evening, as he always did. And I told him about father. And it was sort of an unwritten law that when any of the lads got any news like that, you let the old man know. So he went round and saw the colonel and told him. He was round at breakfast time next morning in a terrible state. He said, Wigham, you poor lad, what must you think of me? Biggest bloody fool walking. I said, what is the matter? Well, he said, here's you telling me that your father's dead, and I'm saying, well, don't worry, old man, I'm sure things will be all right, you know, keep your chin up. Well, I laughed, I couldn't help it. I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I said, goodness sake, don't worry. I said, I got two lots of letters, one in the morning when you came round, one in the afternoon. I said, the one in the morning told me what I told you. The one in the afternoon told me father had died. Oh, he said, thank God for that, child. Hardly slept all night thinking, what on earth will that poor boy think of me? He was a lovely old man. Anyway, once I got on my feet in there, they'd started this camp farther down. We're the only camp notified to the Red Cross on the whole of the line at Narcombeton.
Just before we go into that camp, had you had much contact with home during this period of...
No, I only got
letters and parcels?
No parcels at all. Anybody. I got three or four letters, but that was all. Some of the lads got none at all. Well, the chaps weren't fussy whether we got them or not, you know. But if they had room, perhaps on a barge, they'd stick a bag on and send them up. But I was lucky, I got three or four.
Did you send letters back home?
We had these field message cards, and you may have seen them. I am well, I am not well, and we got those to send. We could put a little message on the bottom, it was very short on so many words, you know. You couldn't say anything without having. But at least it let folks know you were still alive. And my mother did get them, late, as always, of course. But she didn't know I was a prisoner of war until July of the next year, after father had died. He died not knowing. And anyway, there was this camp in a Competent, built as a hospital camp. It was better than the others. The huts were better. There were wooden platforms instead of the split bamboos, and there were stronger built hut timber frames with ratten sides, that sort of thing, you know. And the food was better because we were down country, of course, where near supplies. And so I was filling a party down there. And I went down to Competent. And I was there a week or two, and of course I was feeling better, a little grub and that. I began to put a little bit of weight on, getting a bit of strength back in my legs that very been gone until it's come back now, I think. And so I thought, well, the blazer sitting about my backside all day doing nothing like this, that I volunteered as a medical orderly. No medical orderly experience whatsoever. I told them that, of course. But they were so short, they were pleased to have anybody who was willing, you know.
How big was this camp?
Oh, yeah. I never knew the exact number of folks, but it was a fairly big camp. Must have been 2,000 or 3,000 blokes in it, I'd say, you know.
Well, what were you doing at this time? Before we come on to the medical orderly part, what was your daily routine?
In the camp? Nothing, you were just there as...
You weren't working?
No, it wasn't a working camp, it was there as sick men. It had a theatre, and of sorts, you know, but better than the bamboo huts up the line, and it had some better, more medical facilities, and so I thought, well, if I could work a bit, I'm helping my own lads, which is a thumping sight better than working for the Japs. So I volunteered as a medical orderly, and I got taken on. We had some queer jobs to do at times, and we had to learn fast. My ward master was a first-class warrant officer, regular army, RAMC. And he said, you know, you lads, you know far more than a second-class medical orderly in the army. He said, you've had to learn the hard way. I was giving injections, I was doing dressings, all sorts of things, you know, dishing out medicines and bed baths, of course, and bed pans, such as they were, thunder boxes, we used to call them. There was a lot of biscuit tins inside a wooden case with a hole cut in the top, you know. And a lot of those were used. The worst job we had, you see, although it was better equipped than up country, there was still a shortage because there were so many fellas coming down. And we used to take the dressings, lint and that, off filthy wounds, and they'd be, oh, you know, full of all sorts of filth.
What sort of things were you treating?
Everything. Wounds, these tropical ulcers, and then typhus, malaria, all sorts of things. In fact, they operated, he died, poor lad, an American naval officer. They operated on him for brain hernia, brain hemorrhage, and not hemorrhage, brain tumour. What am I talking about? Yeah, wait a minute. He has a brain tumour. But of course, they had no x-rays or anything. So all they could do was open you up to investigate, you see. My battery captain, bless him, he had 21 operations for cancer. And he died about 6 weeks before we released him. That was the bloke I said early on about, damn it, where's my pipe, you know, and we got in the middle of the air raid. Great fella. But we used to get these filthy dressings, and we had to take them out, clean all the gunge and filth off them, and then we had another container with disinfectant in. We used to have to wash them in this disinfectant, and then boil them up and dry them and use them again. How we didn't get disease on our hands, I don't know. I suppose the disinfectant and one thing, and the water washing them in. But it was a very unpleasant job, was that. But it had to be done, you know.
You must have seen many horrible cases.
Oh, there were. Yes, there were some very, very sad, nasty cases, poor lads. That there was one Australian I knew, he got abscess, internal abscess in the rectum, and he'd been out in Australia a lot of years, and he came from Craighead, and they actually opened him up and had to cut it away the length of the bowel and bring the bowel down and make a new rectum. He got home. How long he lived, Tommy, I don't know. A nice chap he was.
What were the medical facilities like? I mean, operating theatres, I would imagine, were quite basic.
Oh, they were pretty basic, but there were some inside better than up the line where, you know, they just had these bamboo slats to lie around on and soil on the floor with dust flying about and no decent lights or anything like that. That they were basic. I mean, I had my appendix out in the place. But I've got a photograph somewhere of the operating table I lost my appendix on. But but it's amazing the operations that they did there. Then I was 14 months on that. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
What was the daily routine like?
Well, on shift work, of course, you know. And it was like any hospital. Yeah, except you didn't have beds to make, because nobody had any bedding or anything. You were just on these boards, anything you had to lie on. But bed baths and as I say, bed pans and things are empty, and medicines to dish out, and dressings to redo, and this sort of thing, you know. That there were certain limits which we couldn't go to. Well, I had to have the more experienced orderlies on them, who wouldn't have let us take stitches out or anything like that, you know. That I would have had to go. If they'd showed me, well, I saw them taken out, and afterwards I could have taken them out, you know. But after.
And what about the Japanese at this time? How were you being trapped by the Japanese?
not too bad at all, really. As long as you behave yourself, you know. They had a list of some damn silly camp orders at times, but as long as you towed the line. And we had all our officers still with us then, but I was in that camp when they segregated the officers. They'd start opening an officers' camp, and they took the officers away, except medical officers and padres. But our other officers were moved to this officers' camp.
What about your free time? What could you do in your free time?
Just amuse yourself, really. I mean, you know, you had friends, you sit in a group and talk about things, and they formed concert parties, and they had a theatre going, and, you know, for amateur theatre work, and orchestra with homemade instruments very often, and they used to come in round into the wards, into the huts at night, you know, and in the evening, that is, you know, and entertain the lads and that sort of thing. Debates and discussions. Anybody who'd had an interesting sort of life would give a lecture on what they'd been doing. They could, you know, let somebody know that, oh, I'll give a talk if the lads want it. And yes, that's all you could do, really.
Was there any local villages or towns nearby?
Oh, and Accompetan itself was quite a township. And a blooming great big Buddhist temple there, just outside of the camp. Big dome covered with gold leaf and that, you know. Big place in Accompetan temple. But we never got into the town, of course. You know, that village was there, all right. The railway ran through it.
But did you have any contact with any of the local population?
No. Some of them came in labouring on jobs, but they didn't like you having any contact with them.
But was discipline still strict?
It was. Not fiercely strict, you know. I mean, you still had to bow to the flipping Japs and salute their officers and all the rest of it. And as I say, there were camp rules. But there were no beatings. They weren't going around beating folks up or anything like that. It was a hospital, after all, you know. Except that it wasn't marked. There were no Red Crosses about it or anything like that. But it was notified to the Red Cross. But this big Buddhist temple, the Lancasters and Flying Forts and things used to use it as a sort of location spot for their raids over to Saigon and down into Bangkok, and they'd come rattling over at night. I've known them come over so low that the slipstream from them lifted the atap on the roof, hood moves like that, you know, just flopping up and down as these big fellas lumbered over. But used to scare the Japs stiff. As far as we were concerned, we hoped that they were doing a good job, you know.
That must have had a good effect on morale, did it?
Oh, yes, it lifted morale a bit. Unfortunately, we got a squad of fellas in who had been at Nampuduk, which was a marshalling yard, and the planes bombed it, and the camp was right beside it, and they hit the camp, killed a lot of our fellas, or quite a number, and we got those fellas brought into the camp and the injured. Well, they were very nervous, of course, when the bombers went over, as you can imagine.
When was this? What period of time were you in this camp?
Well, this was 1944 and early 45. because at the end of the 14 months that I was put onto a working party and sent down to Bangkok, and we were taken along to the Anglo-American wharf, big warehouse or go downs as they call them, and we were billeted in there for a bit. And
what sort of work were you doing there?
There we worked in a wood yard, stacking wood and one thing another, and odd jobs like that. But we weren't there too long before they moved us out to the rifle range. It was a party of 80 of us. We went out to the rifle range where there was a regiment of about 2,000 fighting troops, different type of scruff than we had on the line, not much better, but more disciplined, you know. And there, against all Geneva Convention, they had us building weapon pits for them on the for the defence of Bangkok, you know. And we were there a week or two.
What sort of place was Bangkok? What were your impressions of that?
Bangkok, you could see at its best, must have been very nice, what we saw of it, you know. That I wouldn't mind, like we've gone back and seen Bangkok in peacetime. That I think it must have been quite an attractive city, I think.
Did you have much to do with the locals?
No. We had nothing to do with them at all. They weren't allowed. They were kept strict. And of course, once we got up with these fighting troops, you know, who were there on their rifle range, there were no ties coming in among us.
How were you being fed?
There, very good. We had to work steadily. But a lantern-jawed officer, a captain, smart little man he was, and he spoke a little bit of English. And he came when the day we went up there and said to us, "Now look, if you work for me, I'll see you fed." And he was good as his word, and the grub was damn good, you know, in comparison. It was good stews and this sort of thing. We got, he's so well fed.
So what was your daily routine here? What were you doing?
As I say, building weapon pits, gun emplacements and that sort of thing. But there was one day, a plane came over. It was looked like a Japanese twin-engine bomber. And he dropped leaflets. We thought, what the devil's a Japanese plane dropping leaflets on Bangkok for, where it's full of Jap troops? However, that was it. None of them came near me. And in any case, if they had, the Japs didn't like you picking anything like that up. But that night, after we had our meal and all knocking about and that, away over the field from us was another big hut like ours, and that was the headquarters of their signalers. And they started burning all sorts of stuff outside. Oh, the lads got excited, you know. They're burning all this stuff. Oh, what's this mean? I'm maybe getting a bit cynical by that, so I don't think it means anything personally. What do you mean? It must do. Well, as if every office accumulates an awful lot of paper junk, but they've got to get rid of it. That's like they're just burning it off. So we went to bed. The next morning, when we got up and had breakfast, and we'd had our Yesami day that day. That's the half day off, you know. On our Yesami day, and we were having our breakfast when the Japanese sergeant who was in charge of our squad, he's quite not a bad little bloke really, He came bounding up the stairs, grinning all over his face. And, all day, Yasumi. Huh? Yasumi, all day. After Mishi, back to harbour camp. That was the go downs on the river, you know. Devil, there's plenty of work still to be done. We had our Yasumi yesterday. So we just wandered around outside, and a Japanese officer cadet, he was a nice lad, I mean, goddamn lad, a lad called Ricardo with a beautiful tenor voice. He used to go out with us every day working. And as long as we kept just working steadily, Ricardo used to get under a shady tree and sit and sing Madame Butterfly and all the operas going. It was a beautiful voice, a nice lad. Wouldn't be, he'd just be about my age, if that. And he came round and started chatting to us. He spoke good English. And we said to him, Mr. Ricardo, yesterday, why on earth did a Japanese bomber fly over Bangkok dropping leaflets when the place is full of your fellas? He said, I don't know, I couldn't tell you. The thing was, neither he or us, up to that time, had seen a Dakota. And a Dakota was very similar to a twin-engine Japanese bomber, you see. But he was baffled, no. So we talked to him for a bit. And then we wandered back into the hut. And we were just standing around a little bit. Group was talking, and there was a Dutch Eurasian lad amongst us, and I said, just laughingly really, and, you know, I said, I think the war must be over. Why did you say that? I said, well, I had a, and this is perfectly true, by the way, absolutely, as I'm sitting here, this is true. I said, last night I had a dream, a very clear dream really. And there was an American officer sitting behind a big desk with a pen in his hand. He said, I reckon he was signing the peace treaty, etc., you know. And this little Eurasian went as pale as his dusky face would let him. And he said, Sergeant, did you see yesterday's leaflets? I said, no, I said, I haven't seen them. There wasn't one came anywhere near me. Should come to my bed space. And he wanted to come near him and picked it up. And he had it slipped under his bed, you know. And a whole load of Japanese stuff, of course. And on one side was a photograph in, I forget what they call it now, a sort of purpley movie, so. Of a badly shattered city, which presumably was Nagasaki or Hiroshima, the bomb. On the other side, MacArthur sitting at a desk with a pen in his hand. Well, I went as pale as the other bloke. I got a shock of my life. Yeah. And anyway, we went outside again. One or two of us standing talking, and Ricardo came round again, this officer cadet. Oh, his face was down here, poor lad. And he said, gentlemen, keep this to yourselves. He just selected one or two of us who'd gone fairly well with. He just keep this to yourselves for now. But as much as I regret to have to say it, the Japanese army has capitulated. Which, honestly, you know, you couldn't have feeling sorry for the poor lad. He looked so crestfallen. And anyway, as I said, that afternoon we were going back to...
How did you all feel when he said that?
Well, we hoped that it was right. But it had so many tales, so many times that Japs had said things that we mistrusted them, you know. And we thought, oh, well, if we're going back to the harbour camp this afternoon, the tide will tell us as we drive through. Because we're on an open back lorry, you know. So we drove through and everybody was just going about their business as normal. Because what I think was actually the case was that the capitulation had actually taken place the day before, later on the day before, you know. And I think the tides had probably been celebrating overnight and we're feeling the effects the next morning, you know.